Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for July 5th, 2026, the cover story, The Revolution, Through the Eyes of Seven Everyday Founders. In the 50 years since the bicentennial, the last major celebration of the nation's birth, our knowledge of the American Revolution has radically expanded. The Founding Fathers remain the central figures, but since the 1970s, historians have uncovered the fascinating, dramatic lives of many other players whose contributions were previously overlooked or lost in the archives. To mark the country's 250th anniversary, the New York Times Magazine asked seven leading historians to each write about one of these everyday founders, a participant in the great drama of the nation's birth, whose story has rarely been told. Seen through these perspectives, the story looks different, and that's the point. To fully comprehend the American Revolution, we need both the towering few and the faceless many, Jane Kamensky, the president of Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, and an emerita historian at Harvard, writes in her introduction to the project. All were ordinary and made themselves extraordinary. All took advantage of a moment of possibility, of rupture, to pursue happiness for themselves, their families, their people, their country. The story starts in 1763, when Britain defeated France in the Seven Years' War and became the dominant power in North America. The Treaty of Paris ceded nearly all French territory east of the Mississippi to the British crown. But the victory created a new political rift. King George III sought to limit westward expansion into native territories to avoid expensive new frontier wars and protect the fur trade, while colonial farmers felt entitled to the soil that had just been won. Land, not taxes, was the first grievance that sparked conflict between Britain and its colonies, and one native leader knew that the fate of his people hung in the balance. In the winter of 1765, a man and his wife set out on a 275-mile journey by snowshoe. The man was Oneida leader named Agualungdongwas, translated as Breaking of the Twigs. A pious Christian with a gentle manner and a gift for oratory, he was known to the colonists as Good Peter. He was traveling to Connecticut to request that a missionary be sent to his village in central New York. Moving through settled territory was dangerous. Anti-native sentiment ran high among the colonists, but Peter carried an official pass to help ensure their safety. The further east they traveled, the more evident it became that colonists had transformed the land. Farms had replaced forests, and the growth of the colonial population was driving demand for land to the west, native land. 2 years earlier, in 1763, King George III forbade settlement of native territory beyond the Appalachian Ridge. The settlers resented and sometimes defied this order. As Good Peter and his wife trekked through New England, they must have wondered how Britain could possibly keep its colonists contained. If the Oneida were to have a future on their land, he thought, they would have to find ways to coexist with the colonists. When the Revolutionary War broke out, Good Peter urged Oneida warriors to assist the Patriots as scouts, spies, and fighters. They became the colonists' most important native allies. At war's end, Good Peter sought to parlay the respect he had earned into securing Oneida ownership of their ancestral lands. Good Peter made a deal with the Patriots, but he was ultimately betrayed. Good Peter's journey into thickly populated New England had made clear to him that power now rested with common settlers, not with British officials, and not with natives. Good Peter, then probably in his 40s, returned home successful in his request for a missionary to serve his town, Oquaga. Located near present-day Binghamton, New York, Oquaga was in the midst of great changes. It had been founded and led by Oneidas, who were part of the Haudenosaunce Iroquois Confederacy, a powerful alliance with five other Native nations across New York: the Mohawk, Onondaga, Cayuga, Tuscarora, and Seneca. Over the preceding decades, Oquaga had become a haven for Native peoples from as far away as North Carolina who were fleeing the results of colonial settlement, war, disease, game depletion, and political strife. Religion helped mediate the cultural differences at Oquaga. By the 1760s, most Oquagans were at least nominally Christian. Protestant Christianity had thrived there since the town received its first missionary in the 1740s. Good Peter and an older Oneida man named Isaac de Cayanacera, who had been among the first converts, were leaders in the local congregation, which had operated mostly independent of white supervision since its establishment. Good Peter was also the schoolmaster. But tensions that echoed the conflict between Britain and its colonies were brewing between the two men. Land was one issue. In a treaty with the Crown in 1768, the Haudenosaunee accepted a settlement boundary that ran perilously close to the town. Isaac believed the British would protect Oquaga going forward. His trust in the British may have been partly due to familial connections. His daughter had married the Mohawk leader known as Joseph Brant, who was close to the British superintendent for Indian affairs, Sir William Johnson. A large number of Mohawks were moving to Oquaga, and they remained loyal to Johnson. Another cause of tension was religious. Good Peter was more deeply affected by a general spirit of dissent that was spreading through the colonies. His visit to Connecticut had strengthened his relationship with New England's radical Calvinists. They were critical of the Church of England, whose emphasis on ceremony smacked of Roman Catholicism, which they regarded as wicked. To Good Peter's dismay, the Mohawks arriving at Oquaga were accustomed to Church of England practices, including more relaxed standards for baptism into the faith. While Isaac supported these standards, Good Peter was left to wonder whether other British institutions were equally hollow. The stakes of the politico-religious conflict at Oquaga rose with the outbreak of hostilities between colonists and Britain at Lexington and Concord in 1775. The Patriots already had a healthy fear of the British military. That fear tipped into panic when they considered the possibility that Britain might recruit Native allies. This raised the prospect of a second possible decisive front against the Patriots to the west. The Haudenosaunee initially declared neutrality, but every village and even every individual retained the right to follow their own judgment. Eventually, most Mohawks, Onondagas, Cayugas, and Senecas would side with Britain. Good Peter would help convince the majority of Oneidas and Tuscaroras to cast their lot with the Patriots. In 1776, as the Mohawk contingent at Oquaga continued to grow, strengthening pro-British sentiment there, Good Peter decided to relocate northward to the Oneida Nation's principal town, Kanawalo-Holly, near Oneida Lake. There he could work alongside the Reverend Samuel Kirkland, a staunch Calvinist who spoke the Oneida language and who had traveled to Philadelphia to consult with the Second Continental Congress on Indian affairs. The Kanawalo-Holly Oneida's support for the Patriots was driven by their familiarity with neighboring communities of colonial settlers. Proximity had fostered some close personal relations, along with the knowledge that the Patriots would be fierce allies and dangerous enemies. Good Peter's move to Kanawalo-Holly enhanced his status, By August, he had been elevated to the role of speaker for the Warriors of the Oneida Nation. He was past fighting age, but the Warriors wished to avail themselves of his advice and eloquence. At a council that month with the Patriot General Philip Schuyler, Good Peter delivered a speech on behalf of the Oneida and Tuscarora Warriors, in which he preemptively absolved the Patriots for any harm they might inflict upon Native warriors who fought them. Oneida warriors displayed their utility as fighters the next year. 60 Oneidas marched with the local militia in an attempt to relieve Fort Stanwix, only 12 miles from Kanawala Holi. They lost an unknown number of fighters in the ensuing Battle of Oriskany. It was one of the bloodier encounters of the war and one of great significance. Britain's northern campaign that year involved a two-pronged invasion from Canada, and Oriskany contributed to the collapse of the Western incursion. The month after, Oneida warriors traveled east to the Hudson River, where they harried the British army at Saratoga and helped force the British commander, General John Burgoyne, to surrender there in October 1777. Good Peter sent a congratulatory message to the victorious General Horatio Gates on behalf of the Oneida warriors, and it was printed in the New Jersey Gazette. The Oneidas continued to serve the Patriots as scouts, spies, and soldiers for the duration of the war, earning praise and 10 officers' commissions from Congress. Beginning in 1777, Joseph Brant had used Oquaga as a base for which to attack Patriot settlements. The Patriots retaliated in October 1778 by destroying the town. They left one house standing, which, according to a colonel's report, belonged to a friend Indian, probably Good Peter. Identifying Good Peter as a steady and sincere friend to the 13 United States of America, an Indian Affairs commissioner named Volkert Dow empowered him to recruit refugees from Oquaga who were sympathetic to the Patriot cause, and requested protection for anyone Good Peter vouched for. Destroying Oquaga did not stop the raids by hostile Haudenosaunee. However, and in 1779, under significant public pressure, General George Washington devoted a significant portion of the Continental Army to destroying more than 40 Haudenosaunee settlements, including some inhabited by neutrals. The Patriots had initially concealed their plans from the Oneidas, predicting their disapproval. The Haudenosaunee lost homes and fields and orchards to the Patriot torch, but suffered few casualties and took refuge at British Fort Niagara. The Patriots had intended to cow the Haudenosaunee into submission, but the campaign only deepened Haudenosaunee alienation without constraining their capacity to strike. So in January 1780, General Schuyler met in Albany with a pair of neutral Mohawks, Little Abraham and Johannes Krine. Hoping their diplomacy could achieve what Patriot arms had not, Schuyler endorsed their proposal that the Haudenosaunee abandon the British in exchange for a cessation of Patriot hostilities. Little Abraham and Krine set out to carry the proposal to Fort Niagara. Stopping en route at Kanawala Holi, they met with the Oneidas, who agreed to support the effort and designated Good Peter as one of their emissaries. Good Peter said that he did not expect to be requested to go to his enemies, but pledged to go and do everything for the good of his country. Along with another older chief warrior, Skenandon, Good Peter once again donned his snowshoes. The four men endured terrible cold and snow on the 200-mile trek to Fort Niagara. Their reception proved even colder. A formal council was held several days after their arrival. Good Peter and the others delivered speeches and presented gifts, including belts made of wampum, or beads made from shells, that certified the sincerity and import of their words. Their overtures were rejected, and the belts returned with contempt. The commander at Fort Niagara, Guy Johnson, viewed good Peter and the other emissaries with concern. If they stayed, they might yet breed subversion. If they returned home, they could convey intelligence about the fort. Johnson ordered the four men placed in irons and confined to a space ominously called the Black Hole. Despite the objection of some of the Haudenosaunee to such harsh treatment, this imprisonment lasted up to 5 months. "Our confinement was long and rigorous," good Peter later recalled, "but he withstood it by trusting in the Great Spirit for his assistance." His companions did not fare as well. One of Scanandan's descendants recalled that he was sore and stiff with the severities of his wretched confinement in chains. Little Abraham died in prison, most likely as a result of his treatment. In 1780, Britain shifted its focus to the south. Good Peter and Scanandan were released from the Black Hole, but occasional raids and rumors of patriot attacks were enough to justify keeping the two men close. The British, understanding both men's value to the patriots, saw them as bargaining chips. They remanded them to the custody of their Haudenosaunee allies. When news of the peace terms between the British and the United States finally became known in 1783, good Peter was vindicated in his lack of faith in Britain. The British had negotiated no protections for their native allies. They also relinquished all their claims to territory south of Canada, as far west as the Mississippi River. Appeasing the United States helped Britain's commerce and disrupted French expectations of a preferential relationship with its wartime ally. The Haudenosaunee were stunned by Britain's apparent diplomatic collapse. Even British officers expressed consternation at the outcome. Sir Frederick Haldimand, the governor of Quebec, wrote to a confidant, "I am heartily ashamed and wish I was in the interior of Tartary." The disorganization of Congress delayed peace negotiations with the Haudenosaunee, extending the emissaries' captivity into 1784. The United States and the Haudenosaunee finally met at Fort Stanwix in October. One of the initial demands made by the U.S. Treaty Commissioners was that Good Peter, Scanandan, and Crine be released, almost 5 years after their seizure. The U.S. commissioners angered the Haudenosaunee by asserting that the United States was the sole sovereigns of all the land east of the Mississippi. Most of that land had never been ceded to Britain. It had only ever been under native control. The United States also demanded a swath of territory along the Niagara River and the relinquishment of all Haudenosaunee claims to lands to the south and west of New York. Toward the Oneidas and the Tuscaroras, their allies, the U.S. commissioners adopted a friendlier stance. They observed that it did not become the United States to forget those nations who preserved their faith to them, so the Oneidas and the Tuscaroras would be secured in the full and free enjoyment of those possessions. The Oneida homeland seemed safe for now. Good Peter thought the end of the war would bring an end to the conflict between the Oneidas, the rest of the Confederacy, and the settlers. He expected, in his own words, to have sat down in peace and enjoy pleasant days. Things would not be so simple, however. The fledgling national government's exclusive right to deal with natives, as outlined in the Articles of Confederation and later the Constitution, were challenged by New York State and even some private citizens. The Oneidas soon found themselves confronted by competing suitors for their land who gave them conflicting information, as well as money and liquor. The resulting was an atmosphere of confusion and insecurity that lent itself to precipitous deal-making. New York needed Haudenosaunee land to pay debts incurred during the war, and the state's governor, George Clinton, exhibited few scruples in obtaining it. In June 1785, Clinton called the Oneidas to Fort Herkimer for a treaty with the state and demanded a large tract of land. Good Peter spoke for the Oneidas, countering Clinton's demand with a proposal that reflected his desire to reconcile competing interests. The Oneidas would lease a tract to New York for the benefit of any poor people of his state who had no lands, as he later recalled. There was precedent for such an arrangement in both cultures. The solution of paying to rent native land was obvious, equitable, and immediately rejected. In the grand scheme of native settler relations, Good Peter's offer represents a road not taken. An incredulous Clinton deemed the proposal dishonorable because it would make the government of the state tributary to you. In response, he raised the specter of a settler invasion of Oneida lands. Good Peter withdrew as the Oneidas negotiator, and the meeting ended with the Oneidas trying to appease the governor by ceding about 300,000 acres for $11,500 in the hopes that this would be the state's last application for lands. It would not be. In 1788, a New York assemblyman, John Livingston, misrepresented himself to the Oneidas as a state agent and talked them into leasing his New York Genesee Company of Adventures, about 5 million acres, nearly all their remaining territory, for a term of 999 years. Upon learning of the contract, the state legislature promptly nullified it. Concealing that the lease had already been voided, Clinton soon called another meeting with the Oneidas at Fort Stanwix. He informed them that the only way to save their land was to lease it to the state instead. The Oneidas complied. Unbeknown to them, the treaty was actually a sale. Clinton used similar tactics to sign treaties with other Haudenosaunee nations. Clinton's subterfuges plunged Good Peter and the Oneidas into despair, but also alarmed President George Washington. Abusing the Haudenosaunee challenged federal supremacy in Indian affairs and spurred ongoing military resistance by Native Americans in the Ohio country who feared a similar fate. Washington's concerns spiked after natives defeated the U.S. Army at the Battle of the Wabash in late 1791. The visit of a Haudenosaunee delegation to the federal government in Philadelphia the next spring provided an opportunity to calm the waters. Good Peter was one of nearly 50 chiefs who were greeted in Philadelphia in March 1792 with fifes and drums. Washington delivered a welcoming address. Postmaster General Timothy Pickering sat down with Good Peter over several days to discuss the Oneidas' land dealings, the details of which shocked him. Good Peter also sat to have his likeness taken by John Trumbull, the preeminent painter of the Revolution. Pickering promised more protection from his nation's citizens in the future. To reciprocate, Good Peter set off for the Ohio country to assist at a diplomatic council at the administration's behest. En route, Good Peter stopped at Buffalo Creek in the vicinity of his former captivity. There he was swept up in an outbreak of an unspecified illness. On August 25th, the U.S. Indian agent Israel Chapin wrote Secretary of War Henry Knox of the death of Good Peter, for which I am extremely sorry, as I think he was capable of doing much good among the Indians. Knox relayed the news to the president. Kirkland wrote in his diary that the whole Confederacy will feel the loss. He was referring to the Haudenosaunee, but he might just as well have meant the United States. Good Peter's influence transcended his death, however. It was reflected in the U.S. treaty that Pickering completed with the Haudenosaunee Confederacy of Canandaigua in 1794. Unlike the 1784 Treaty of Fort Stanwix, Pickering's treaty was negotiated, not dictated. It returned some lands taken at the earlier treaty and confirmed that the remaining Haudenosaunee lands could not be taken by anyone, including New York, except in treaties conducted under federal supervision. Both the Haudenosaunee and the United States recognized each other's sovereignty within their respective domains. Haudenosaunee people continue to gather at Canada Daigua every November 11th to reaffirm their community and commemorate the treaty that recognized their sovereignty. Pickering's actions after the Canandaigua Treaty honored Good Peter's essential role. He went to the Kanawala Hali and spent 10 days conducting a census of losses sustained in its wartime destruction. He observed that the United States, in the time of their distress, acknowledged their obligations to these faithful friends and now took action to acquit them. Good Peter's sacrifice and eloquence contributed to the creation of a federal treaty system that recognized Native rights to land and sovereignty. Although the grievous flaws of the system allowed it to become an instrument of dispossession by rallying to defend their treaty rights, the Oneidas and others ultimately defied the expectations and hopes of many that they would simply disappear. Good Peter lived up to his commitments to both the Oneidas and the United States, but the interests of his people proved impossible to reconcile with the aspirations of the new nation, which was so populous and so hungry for land. By strengthening the first administration's willingness to recognize Native sovereignty, Good Peter held open a space, both legal and territorial, in which Native Americans could survive. It is thanks in part to him that the United States can celebrate its 250th birthday, and that it does so alongside other, older American nations. Kareem M. Tiro, who wrote this article, is a professor of history at Xavier University, specializing in the colonial, revolutionary, and early national periods, as well as Native American history. The thousands of farmers pushing into Native territories were driven in large part by economics. For colonial farmers, land was a path to economic security, but good farmland near the coast was expensive or unavailable. In parts of the North, much of it was owned by elites who hired tenant farmers to work their land and charged them high rents to do so. Elsewhere, yeoman farmers complained of unjust taxes and extortion by local officials. In the years leading up to the war, frustrated farmers in North Carolina and the Hudson Valley launched uprisings to defy corrupt officials and wealthy landlords. One of those early uprisings occurred in a place called Alamance. The Revolutionary War began on April 19, 1775, the day British regulars killed 8 militiamen in Lexington, Massachusetts. But the first battle of the founding era took place 4 years earlier near Great Alamance Creek in North Carolina. On May 16, 1771, militiamen commanded by the Colonel Governor William Tryon faced off against about 2,000 farmers. The farmers called themselves regulators. For years, they had tried to rein in corruption by regulating lawyers and local officials who charged more for their services than the law allowed. They also objected to the grievous supplemental tax imposed on them to pay for Tryon's lavish new palace near the coast. The regulators had endured endless meetings, adopted countless resolutions. Some had beat up attorneys and court clerks. Now it was war. Tryon's soldiers had artillery and a clear command structure, while the regulators' democratic principles prevented them from even selecting a military leader. Tryon's army easily defeated the regulators, killing about 20 of them. After the battle, the governor hanged a captured regulator on the battlefield, but the man he wanted most wasn't there. Herman Husband had not fought in the Battle of Alamance. He was a pacifist, but Tryon wanted him anyway, dead or alive. With his fiery speeches and influential pamphlets, Husband had transformed his fellow farmers' complaints into a cause. Husband fled north, and Tryon's army laid waste to his farm and his home. Taking refuge in Pennsylvania in the early 1770s, Husband adopted a pseudonym, Tuscape death and resumed his battle against exploitation. Herman Husband's radical egalitarianism would make him a thorn in the side of the Founding Fathers. Husband himself was far from downtrodden. The firstborn son of a wealthy Maryland family, he had accumulated some 10,000 acres of land in the North Carolina backcountry by the time of the Battle of Alamance, but his sense of justice tilted him toward the underdog. He once sided against his own Quaker congregation in a dispute about how to handle the case of a girl accused of insufficiently resisting a sexual assault. For his efforts, the congregation kicked him out. Most farmers, though, faced hard work and even harder business conditions. A chronic shortage of cash, Parliament had restricted the printing of paper money, left creditors demanding gold, silver, or hard assets when debts came due. Husband later described sheriffs collecting taxes from neighbors in the form of the very horses and cows they needed to work their way back to solvency, as if to stab ourselves to the very heart and dry up our fountains. In early 1766, protests by a shadowy resistance network called the Sons of Liberty, which included several future signers of the Declaration of Independence, forced Parliament to repeal the Stamp Act, a wildly unpopular tax on legal documents, newspapers, and pamphlets. And that gave Husband an idea. What if farmers formed their own organization aimed not at pressuring King George III or Parliament, but at restraining internal oppressors right there in North Carolina? That summer, Husband posted a call to discuss whether the free men of this country labor under any abuses of power, and in the series of meetings that followed, the association that would come to be known as the Regulators took shape. In pamphlets and in person, Husband enumerated the many grievous oppressions that farmers faced. Lawyers were permitted to charge their clients no more than 15 shillings per case, but they regularly billed as much as £5, nearly seven times the lawful sum. County clerks exacted fees so high that farmers often had to work them off, for instance, by raking hay or shoveling manure on the clerk's farm, sometimes for months. Husband reported the case of one backcountry farmer, William Few, who was sued for a £10 debt, then charged another £60 in court costs when he lost. One early regulator referred to clerks, attorneys, and other members of his county's courthouse ring as hungry caterpillars. Husband was jailed on treason charges for his role in stirring up the regulators, but was quickly released. For a short time, he was even able to transform his advocacy into a seat in North Carolina's colonial assembly. But this experiment with working within the system came to a rapid end. Colleagues there expelled him, claiming he had published a libel against a provincial judge. For their part, many regulators contended that the assemblymen who deserved to be expelled were many lawyers who dominated the assembly. In fact, they argued, the body should bar them from serving altogether. Husband remained a Quaker and a pacifist. His only weapons were his words, but violence was in the air. The increasingly organized protesters were banding together to withhold tax and rent payments, and some were going a step further to violently recover property the sheriffs had seized or mob the courts where merchants went to collect debts. Others had made pacts. If one of them was thrown in jail, the rest would break him out. Such efforts prompted the North Carolina Assembly to adopt a law based on the English Riot Act, which in earlier decades not only outlawed the act of private assembly, but also authorized the use of deadly force against anyone who did unlawfully assemble. It was on this basis that Governor Tryon formed the militia that ultimately met the rebels at Great Alamance Creek. A month after the battle, six regulators were hanged for treason. To the provincial gentry, the fugitive Husband stood as an even greater villain. He had betrayed not only the government, but also his class. Trion put a bounty of 1,000 acres of land plus 100 pounds on four remaining figures of the revolt, three escaped fighters and husband, whose only crimes were writing and speaking. It would seem difficult to survive long with such a bounty on your head, much less re-enter the political world. But husband, while still an outlaw in the eyes of the North Carolina authorities, managed to build a new home out at the foot of the Allegheny Mountains in western Pennsylvania. At first, this refuge suited him. After the colonies declared independence, Pennsylvania, the adoptive home of Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine, enacted what was then arguably the world's most democratic constitution. Assemblymen had to face the voters every year, and no court had the power to overturn their legislation. Laws could not be stopped by the Senate or governor either, because Pennsylvania had neither. In 1777, husband ran for a seat in Pennsylvania's newly formed General Assembly. The voters backed him, and he again took his place within the system for a single year-long term. Within a few years, husband would find himself once again working from the outside. In 1781, the Assembly voted in a law that resembled Parliament's earlier ban on paper money, requiring farmers to pay their debts using hard currency, silver and gold. Husband went to work, publishing a series of anonymous pamphlets at his own expense, in vain against the law and against the Assembly's confiscatory taxes and the ongoing exactions of local officials. More so than in North Carolina, husband also attacked those problems at the root. As he saw it, even post-independence Pennsylvania, with its ostensibly democratic constitution, was ruled by the rich, and he had an unusual idea about why. I would now like to just take a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Husband believed that Pennsylvania's legislative districts, which spanned entire counties, contained far too many voters. An average of 25,000 people lived in each county. In theory, every voter among them was a potential office holder. But then, as now, to be elected, you had to be well known. And husband understood that name recognition was highly correlated with wealth. Our own men in the township, he lamented in a 1782 pamphlet, were simply not enough known to have any influence in the other parts of the county. Poor and middle-income candidates stood no chance of winning. Some wealthy office seekers, especially merchants and tavern keepers, enjoyed an additional political advantage. Today, consumers typically owe money to the banks that issue their credit cards and finance their homes. But in the 18th century, you ran tabs with the retailers themselves, be it the crossroads store or the local pub. In the days before the secret ballot, these debts conferred enormous influence on wealthy creditors. They could ease up on debtors who voted their way and crack down on those who didn't. In Pennsylvania's oversized election districts, only a fraction of voters regularly ran into their representatives on the street or at church. A majority had no chance to ask their assemblyman how he had voted on important issues. Thus, blindfolded, husband wrote, citizens could not call representatives to any account on election day. Husband believed Pennsylvania could erase much of the wealthy candidate's advantage over the ordinary farmer by shrinking Pennsylvania's election districts. Allowing every hamlet to send its own representative to the assembly would make it unwieldy. So instead, husband suggested that the towns elect delegates to new countrywide legislators. Each of these would then choose that county's delegation to the state assembly. At the base of this pyramid would be new election districts that were so small that even dirt farmers would be well enough known within them to win seats in the county legislature. It could in turn send many of those same farmers on to Philadelphia. Husband thought county legislatures would also combat another obstacle to popular rule, a psychological one. Ordinary Pennsylvanians were likely to see themselves as too insignificant to serve in the state assembly, he wrote, but the county legislatures would provide aspiring statesmen essential experience that in turn would give them the self-confidence they needed to secure higher office and succeed there. The local assemblies would prove as a school to train up and learn men in the nature of all public business and give them utterance to speak to the same, husband wrote. Another of the township representatives' duties would be to take home all the laws that had passed the state assembly and cause them to be read in public. Every townsman would vote on each law, and their local representatives would transmit these town tallies back up through the county legislatures to Philadelphia. The statewide aggregates of these town votes would determine which laws would be affirmed and which would be repealed. By such means, husband aimed to transform Pennsylvania from a republic of the elite into a radical democracy for all. Washington, Hamilton, and other prominent Americans warily monitored husband as he continued his effort to turn their secession from Britain into a radical internal revolution. Many among the elite pronounced him insane. Most of the 55 notable citizens who gathered in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 to write the U.S. Constitution saw the problem of democracy very differently from husband. Rather than seeking to give greater power to a majority of Americans, the architects of the new national government set out to curb what some among them called the excess of democracy out in the states. The framers were wealthy and well-educated, and as such, they made up a small minority in a nation of farmers and tradesmen. They had little faith in the wisdom of the masses and worried that large numbers of indebted farmers might, for instance, force Congress to grant them relief from their much less numerous creditors. They developed several ways to fight the potential tyranny of such majorities. Most straightforwardly, under the Constitution, voters would have no direct say in the selection of the president, federal judges, or, until the 17th Amendment in 1913, U.S. senators. The framers also decided that individual members of the federal Congress would represent far more constituents than their state counterparts, 8 times as many in Pennsylvania, and even more in some other states. Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, a Constitutional Convention delegate from South Carolina, made the thinking behind his decision plain. In the gargantuan new federal election districts, he said, the little demagogue of a petty parish or county will find his importance annihilated. And in a final effort to restrain the majority, the Constitution would also, in James Madison's words, extend the sphere of the most important decision-making from the state to the federal level. Once indomitable states' majorities would cancel one another out at the national level, freeing wise officeholders to vote their consciences. In a private letter to Thomas Jefferson, Madison pronounced, "Divide et impera, divide and conquer," to be the only policy by which a republic can be administered on just principles. The Constitution was ratified in the summer of 1788, and that fall the Pennsylvania Assembly decided that the state's delegation to the first Congress, set to meet in New York City the following spring, would be elected at large, that is, by voters from across the whole state. Husband complained that the assembly might as well have empowered the officers and wealthy men to have held those elections without mocking the public with the farce of casting ballots. Soon public pressure forced the assemblymen to move from the at-large system to the congressional district system. but the districts were still huge, leaving husband's original grievance unsettled. By that time, the extent of husband's alienation was evident in his violating, albeit anonymously, the universal taboo against criticizing George Washington. Washington, the victorious commander-in-chief, had persuaded Congress to give his officers pensions equal to 5 years' pay. Enlisted men received a comparative pittance, though many had lost their farms in their absence. As the Electoral College was unanimously elevating Washington to the presidency in 1789, husband wrote that he wished Washington had shown as much concern for the regular people who were half ruined by the war as he did for the officers who made their fortunes by the war. For decades, husband had based his political writings on biblical prophecy. He believed his reforms would not only give ordinary Americans a say in government, but also commence that thousand years' reign with Christ. He differed with the biblical prophets in only one particular. He thought the New Jerusalem would rise up not in the Holy Land, but in North America, just beyond the Allegheny Mountains. By 1794, husband's disillusionment with the new republic had reached the point where he decided to do something he hadn't done for 23 years. He joined in a rebellion. He felt he had no choice. Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, had formulated a plan for the federal government to assume the state's war debts and to finance the move with a national tax on distilled spirits. Farmers at that time often used whiskey to settle debts when cash was scarce, and many in western Pennsylvania relied on it as the only commodity valuable enough to profitably transport back east over the mountains. Making matters worse, word had gotten around that the purpose of the whiskey tax was to pay off wealthy speculators who had bought up Revolutionary War bonds at a fraction of their face value. Many western Pennsylvanians, having already endured tremendous hardship during the Revolution, were unwilling to suffer again for the sake of the speculators. Instead, bands of resistors began to attack tax collectors, tarring and feathering them. Some set fire to the home of a regional tax official, and a growing mass marched on Pittsburgh. Hamilton derided this whiskey rebellion even as federal troops headed west to crush it. Neither in the first major bloodletting of the founding era at Great Alamance Creek in 1771, nor in the last in western Pennsylvania in 1794 and 1795, did Americans battle British soldiers. In each, they fought other Americans. Nor were these bookends the era's only internal conflicts. Tenants resisted their landlords, slaves exploited wartime chaos and labor shortages to claim their freedom. Young men rioted against the draft, and soldiers mutinied or deserted en masse. Women ran their absent husbands' businesses and in many cases refused to call them master when they finally returned. Husband had tried to keep the whiskey protest peaceful. His only contributions were helping erect a liberty pole and attending a handful of meetings. Yet, in Pennsylvania in 1794, as in North Carolina in 1771, such was the threat this eloquent American posed that he made the most wanted list. President Washington sent Hamilton's army west with the names of only three insurgents to jail. One was Herman Husband. Husband, now 70, was one of the first people arrested. Like many of the people imprisoned in the Philadelphia jail during the winter of 1794-95, he became gravely ill. In May 1795, a grand jury declined to indict him for treason, but did bring a charge of sedition. On that second charge, the trial jury found him innocent and released him. Heading home, husband had traveled only a few miles from the temporary federal capital when his illness killed him. As he lay dying, the peripatetic reformer could take solace not only in the favorable verdict of the Pennsylvania jurors, but also in the decision by North Carolina voters to send him to the provincial assembly a quarter century earlier. In both instances, husband's respect and admiration for ordinary Americans had been heartily reciprocated. He represented the American Revolution that might have been. Woody Holton, who wrote this article about Herman Husband, is a historian and professor at the University of South Carolina who specializes in the overlooked contributions of women, Black people, and Indigenous Americans to the cause of independence. The end of the Seven Years' War not only set in motion a fight over Western land, it also left the British government with enormous debts. To pay them off, Parliament began imposing direct taxes on the colonies through legislation like the Stamp Act. Opposition to the Stamp Act and other royal policies led to intensifying conflict between colonists and the British, particularly in Massachusetts. To maintain control, Britain garrisoned soldiers in Boston. On March 5, 1770, some of these soldiers were guarding a customs house from an angry mob when shots were fired into the crowd, killing five people. Colonial papers quickly spread news of the slaughter, which became known as the Boston Massacre. The event solidified Massachusetts as the epicenter of the growing resistance, and one person who gave this movement a sense of noble purpose was an anonymous local playwright. The American Revolution was a war of the pen as much as a war of the sword. Soaring calls for action made the fight for independence possible. In 1772, before prominent works by people like Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine, a play arrived that set the colonial imagination on fire. Called The Adulateur, the play was published anonymously in a Massachusetts newspaper. In it, a shameless tyrant named Rapacio plots to enslave the people of a free society. He was a thinly veiled version of the colonial governor, Thomas Hutchinson, who had presided over tax policy, repressive laws, and the Boston Massacre. As his avatar, Rapacio declares, "Despotic rule, my first, my sovereign wish." The Adulateur ripped through the young city of Boston. If colonists didn't read it in the paper themselves, they heard it spontaneously read aloud in their local taverns. It affirmed the colonists' growing outrage. Hutchinson and the British not only were limiting their rights, but wanted to crush their liberty. Most readers would have thought that the work, like most of what appeared in newspapers at the time, had been written by a man. But its author was Mercy Otis Warren, a Plymouth housewife. That play and Warren's writings throughout the Revolution helped change the course of history. Mercy Otis Warren was inspired to write by her opposition to tyranny and a personal grievance. Mercy Otis Warren was among the first writers of the Revolutionary period to define the struggle against Britain as a fight against tyranny. Before Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, or Thomas Jefferson penned the Declaration of Independence, Warren helped lay the groundwork by framing the conflict in stirring, dramatic terms. In a series of plays published in the early 1770s, she captivated the reading public by elevating their personal grievances with British rule by using classical tropes and symbolic language. Warren witnessed growing British power early and up close, and she came to believe that the showdown between the colonists and the British officials who ruled them was no self-interested squabble over taxes. It was instead a fundamental clash between freedom and oppression, with roots going back to the Roman Republic. Her plays persuaded many other colonists to see it the same way. For Warren, this was no intellectual exercise. She and her family had been feuding with Thomas Hutchinson since the mid-1750s, more than a decade before anyone was even thinking of revolution. At that time, when Warren was in her 20s, she had no idea that the colonies would eventually fight to leave the British Empire. She was proud to live in the most powerful, most profitable, and what many white colonists saw as the freest empire in the world. She and her beloved husband, a merchant and politician named James Warren, could afford silk, satin, lace, and ribbons for her dresses and imported cheese and wine for their table. James and others in Warren's family, her brother and her father, both named James Otis, were men of consequence who held positions in the Massachusetts colonial government. Raised in the culture of British New England in Barnstable, Massachusetts, Warren was given the rare chance to be tutored alongside her brothers and taught to wield a pen. For the Warrens and the Otises, it was good to be British. But while the empire made Warren's comfortable life possible, she and her family hit what we might call a colonial glass ceiling. They blamed Hutchinson. In 1757, Hutchinson, then a member of the Governor's Council, lobbied against her father's appointment to the same group. 3 years later, the governor appointed Hutchinson as Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Superior Court, adding to a baffling number of appointments that Hutchinson also racked up, eventually including Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts. In 1761, Warren's brother, James Otis Jr., known as Jemmy, argued a case before the Massachusetts Superior Court challenging customs officers' ability to board ships to search for smuggled goods, saying that the practice violated the British Constitution and the colonial rights to due process. As Lieutenant Governor, Hutchinson enforced the laws at issue in the case. As Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Superior Court, he was also the judge. His predictable decision against Otis and the Boston merchants seemed a clear sign of the corruption not only of Hutchinson, but also of the relationship between the British government and its colonies. I am so very sorry to report that I will not have time to finish this article about Mercy Otis Warren. This article was written by Kathleen Duval, who is a historian and a professor at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the author of several books. Thank you very much for joining me for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.